I don't ever want to be boxed in or like labeled. I want to do everything and I want to be able to do everything. I'm not going to take no for an answer. And I'm always going to keep pushing the boundaries for what craft can do. And then I'm going to show it to everyone and talk to everyone about it.
That was Lærke Bagger.
And this is Nordic Portraits.
Lærke Bagger is an internationally renowned knitwear designer and best-selling author. Known for challenging the traditional approach with her bold use of yarn offcuts, beads, and array of colors, Lærke's pieces are some of the most sought after within the world of women's fashion. At the same time, she continues to introduce new patterns to her rapidly growing army of followers as a way of encouraging individuals of all levels of experience and proficiency to pursue knitting. Lærke, welcome to Nordic Portraits.
Thank you so much.
Lærke, I wanted to start by going back to spring 2020.
Yeah.
Where you found yourself, like the rest of the world's population, housebound in the wake of the pandemic.
Yeah.
And you took this opportunity to design a pattern called the Alone Together Sweater.
Yeah.
Which you then made public on your very popular Instagram account. And I just wondered what happened next.
Like the rest of the world, I was really afraid in the first week of the pandemic where nobody knew if you were going to die or your parents going to die, is the whole world going to end? So I thought, I'd never published a pattern before actually. So I thought, now's the time and I need to make myself busy. And handicrafts and crafts have this thing where, you know, it ties people together and you let your mind wander and think about something else. So I thought, now I'll publish it. And let's do it with all the yarns that you have at home because everything is closed. You can't go and buy anything. So in 5 days, I made a pattern and knitted a sweater. I also had a 3-month-old at home and my boyfriend were at home as well working. So he was like totally psyched about me wanting to do this project. And then it completely exploded. That sweater, I'm so sick of the name, Alone Together Sweater. Maybe it's because I think rock stars hate the hits as well. Like they're sick of playing the hits. So, But it completely exploded because it resonated with every follower I had all over the world. It wasn't just Danish people. It was all over the world. And it was a new pattern. And it was a way of using everything you had at home. And you had to be creative because I didn't give like it's going to look like this or it's going to be blue or it's going to be that. You had to use the yarns you had. So all of them were very personal. And then we were all doing it together, sitting in Indonesia and Australia and Denmark and Germany and Sweden and Norway, looking on Instagram what the other knitters were doing.
How is that for you to then see something that you've dreamt up come into fruition in so many different contexts and then personalized in so many ways?
It was so moving. It was so moving and I felt so proud, not only of myself, but of the whole knitting community. You know, I'm a textile designer from the Royal Danish Academy of Fine Arts School of Design. So I have an MA in design. And I always thought that I was going to work in fashion so that the way I would see my designs was people in Fashion Week or on the runway or in shops. But this whole new thing of seeing my designs actually being redesigned, like me setting the frame and then people putting themselves into the frame, so much better. So much better.
You mentioned the knitting community. How would you describe the knitting community?
Like, I sometimes say that it's a rock that you turn and then we just crawled out. Like, we've been laying under a rock for the last 50 years and someone turned the stone and now we're just like, we've been together in the darkness and now we're in the light.
And obviously, that's because knitting has become part of the zeitgeist in recent years. Yeah. Wasn't always cool.
I've always thought it was cool, but no, in the broader sense, no, it wasn't.
And how aware are you and the community of the historical context of knitting? I find it interesting that today it's a form of self-expression, but of course, you only have to go back one or two generations and it was more a matter of necessity.
I'm very aware of it. everything I've ever done, all my patterns and all my designs and techniques come from a book I bought at one time. Like I started collecting knitting books when I was 14 or 15. So now I have this really big, huge library of craft books dating to over 100 years ago. All languages, I just buy them. So for me, the history and the tradition and all the, I want to call it research and these women, mostly women that wrote the books, they were actually craft scientists. But it's never really been celebrated as research. It was like something women did, but they made up this whole language through the fingers.
Yeah, and that must also provide a great form of documentation of how various cultures have expressed themselves over time.
And political and historical and special times of history, people with, for instance, World War II.
Yeah, as a form of protest.
Yeah, and also like with the pussy hat and everything, like there's so many different expressions through craft.
So if we go all the way back to the start, you were born and raised in Aalborg.
Yeah.
You started knitting at a young age?
Yeah, I started knitting when I was 8. And I've basically done all forms of crafts, like crocheting, but also scrapbooking and embroidering. And I just felt that knitting was the craft that was easiest to make clothing in, because crochet is very firm. It has a tendency to be
quite rigid.
Yeah, and also it's better for like furniture, whereas knitting is very organic. So I started knitting when I was 8, and then I never stopped.
And who introduced you to knitting?
It was my mom. Yeah. I come from a crafty family, not a professional crafty family, but I used to say my family is very, we like television and we don't like to be outdoors and do sports and stuff. We like to sit and craft and then watch television.
That's never changed for you.
No, it's my favorite thing ever, still.
So you grew up with your mother and your stepfather. He was a press photographer?
Yeah.
So what did you learn from him?
That was very inspiring as well, because he was self-taught and he had his days were never planned. He didn't go to work at 8 and then come home at 4. Sometimes he would work all day and all night, and sometimes would be off 2 days and he would jump in his car and then go shoot something because someone called. And I always thought, I want to do that. I want to have that freedom. And I thought my mom was really worried because she worked with getting young people employment. And I was like, I don't ever want to have an education. I just want to do what Henning does. His name is Henning. I want to do what Henning does. I want to like fly around and then have the busiest day and then, you know, never know what happens next week, which is quite funny because this is actually what I'm doing essentially.
So at that young age, you mentioned in the past that you were planning to be a fashion designer or work within fashion. You've called yourself a bonheur
extraordinaire,
extraordinaire, redneck extraordinaire. Yeah. I'm curious what that was like for you in your early teenage years, growing up in Aalborg, a provincial city located in the opposite corner of the country to Copenhagen. What was that like for you, and how was that perceived by your family and friends?
Well, you know, my mom and my stepdad, they always supported me. They just wanted me to have an education, which is fair enough, I guess. I didn't really tell anyone that I wanted to be a fashion designer because it felt like such a stupid dream. Like you said, I grew up far away from Copenhagen and there's plenty of creative people in Aalborg. I love the city of Aalborg, but no one really works professionally with creativity as much as, of course, they do in the big cities like Copenhagen. So I never really knew anyone besides Henning that worked with creativity. So I was like, this is never going to happen for me. I'm probably just going to have to start a yarn shop, which I thought that will never work out because I don't want to sell any yarns. I just want to sit and knit and not talk to people. That's like the worst yarn shop ever because that's the basis of a yarn shop. You go and you chat about yarn. So I went to high school, gymnasium, and then afterwards I went to højskole, which is like what?
Yeah, it's more like a trade school.
Yeah, but only for like 6 months, where I thought I was going to be a fashion designer. So I studied fashion design. And that was like a huge failure. It was such a letdown for me because I learned that I was absolutely not going to be a fashion designer because I hate sewing. I hate sewing. It's the worst. I'd rather do dishes or go to the dentist or something. It's the worst.
Why?
It's so boring. You sit at the machine and then you have to wait for it has to be like You have to follow like a linear line, and you have to cut, and you have to measure things. And if you measure wrong, you have to measure again and sew. And then you have to work in that horrible white fabric before you can ever do anything in the good fabric. I was completely thrown off my dream after I went to trade school. So I moved to Copenhagen, and then I thought, I don't know what to do, because I didn't really know that textile design was a thing in school. I thought you could only be like a fashion designer. And I always wanted to work with my hands. You know, while we're talking, I'm sitting and like rubbing my fingers together. It looks weird, I know. So I had a couple of years where my dreams were crushed.
Is it true that you also tried to start 6 months of education of religion and then?
Yeah, I studied at the university because I thought this will never happen for me.
But those fast hands also brought you undone.
Yeah, because I through all the lectures, I was just sitting and knitting. So I didn't take any notes. So when I had to, it was a group exam. It was horrible because I was in the group and we had to go to the exam. I just, you know, I quit school just before the exam because I was like, I can't do anything. I made a bunch of beautiful sweaters. I'll wear them to the exam. And then I thought, okay, maybe I should give this design school a real chance.
So beyond this very strong focus you've always had on your craft, how would your friends have described you then growing up as a teenager in Aalborg?
A party girl? Oh, okay, no. of course, you know, I was never the pretty one. I had a really pretty friend, so I was the funny one. You know, like she was interesting and funny and prettiest, but it sort of became my role that I was the funny and interesting one. And then I like to party. As like I said, I like to go out and I'm very social, and I actually really like going to gymnasium, not the school part, but the social part. And then I would craft at home. And I remember like when I was going to graduate doing the final exams, I was more interested in reading all the old literature than actually studying for the exam. So I just started from the bottom and I read Sartre and Henry Miller and Bukowski and all these very angry old men that an 18-year-old girl were very fascinated by. So, you know, I've always actually only going, like, I went my own way, I guess. I wasn't too worried about the exams or where this was going. I've always wanted to take the way that I felt was interesting. And I still do it. If I'm like drawn to this, if there's something over here, I'm going to go in that direction. Even though my publisher or my boss tells me to go in the other direction, I'm still going to go in where it's interesting.
That interests me about you, the fact that you already said at a young age that you were inspired by Henning's ability as an autodidact. And I wondered then what compelled you to take a formal education? Because you strike me as someone who could have just been like a bull at a gate charging into a career from the age of 18.
I feel like I've actually done that afterwards, because when I get what you're saying, I'm going to go back to the question. But after I graduated from design school, I have in the past, what it was in 15, so I'm not really good at math, but that's like, what, 7, 8 years
ago? 8 years ago, yeah.
I've crossed over into being a writer, doing television, doing freelance work for like all sorts of others. So I feel like I've done exactly what you said, but just after I graduated from design school, I felt like I didn't know enough about creative process. So I didn't learn any techniques, knitting techniques. Well, a little bit, but most of the techniques I learned from books and from experimenting myself. But the creative process, how you access your creative space or how you go from A to B idea-wise, that was important. I learned that at design school.
And how much does that process for you evolve even now?
All the time. All the time. The thing is that when you start doing creative process, if you're in school, you have to do it very elaborately. So it's like, okay, so I'm seeing this painting. How does this painting make me feel? What colors are in the painting? What do those symbol? How can I use that in my knitting? I'm going to do a sample of the colors of the painting. And then you take the step, 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 step. And then at the top of the stairs, you have your own design or whatever. I don't do that anymore. I don't have the time. So now I see the painting and I start working. I don't have to justify anything anymore. So it's still the same thing, just happens a lot faster. Because I don't have to be, oh, and then I chose red because...
And on a practical level, when you are designing a new piece, are you sketching it out beforehand or are you literally just planning it in your mind as you start knitting?
Yeah, I get... it's sort of like, you know, when you have a dream, you wake in the middle of the night and you know you dreamt something and you have this feeling in your body or in your head. That's how I get when I see a new design. I'm like, I want to go in this direction. I remember this dress. I want to do something similar. And then I start knitting. I don't sketch with pens or I sketch with my knitting needle. So I do like my sketches in the textile. And then I start knitting. And then, of course, something happens because the idea is never what happens when you start working on it. And then it slowly becomes something completely different from what I initially thought it was going to be. So I go with the process. I'm never decided on how the design is going to be. I am in the process of creating as long as I possibly can be.
Wow.
Does it make any sense?
Absolutely.
So I never know what it's going to be like. Like the new pieces for the new book, I had this vision that it was going to be a celebration of all the iconic clothing pieces that was part of me growing up. Like playing this fancy lady and also being a child of the 90s. So I wanted that. And then I looked at pictures of myself as a kid and also as a teenager. And then I just started knitting. And, you know, I knew what it was going to communicate. I just didn't know what it was going to look like.
It's interesting because if we talk about your book for a moment, Strike or Knit was a major commercial success. And it struck me while reading it that right from the outset, page one, we see an image of you with two girlfriends drinking beers, giving the middle finger.
Yeah.
Followed by on the next page, you standing on Yomfu Anagil in front of a dive bar with 6 kroner shots. And then a more vulnerable image of you heavily pregnant and knitting in bed. And it just feels like you're really keen to show the many faces of Lagerbagger. Was that particularly important for you when designing the book?
Yeah, absolutely. I, you know, there's a big tradition within knitwear designers that you create a website and then you do like a pattern or a design and then you sell it as a PDF download. And I never wanted to do that. Well, at some point I thought I have to do it. And, you know, this was what we were talking about before, like the road. This is the way I should go because that's where the money is and that's where I can make a living. So let me just make some PDFs. And then I was like moving in the other direction, being like, how can I make this most difficult for myself? Let's publish a book where I spend so much time never knowing if anyone will ever buy it. But I felt like I had to, for me, it's not the design. For me, it's the story about the craft and the person, because it's not like when you go and buy a knitted sweater, that's like 30 minutes 15 minutes to the shop, maybe 45 minutes. When you knit a sweater, you spend maybe 3 months on the same garment. And there's a whole ritual leading up to the knitting of the garment, buying the yarn and deciding on the pattern. And there's so many stories. So I wanted to cater that story to the readers and my followers, and also by showing the life around the craft.
Hmm.
All these different situations where I knit or where I use my craft. And also there was this tendency to, I'm going to try and not offend anyone now, but like this knitty Nora. Are you familiar with that term?
No.
It's, I think it's a phrase used about old people that knit. So if you knit, you're a knitty Nora, you're an old person. Which is so insulting and it's demeaning. And I was just like, we can be girls that party and want to have beers and knit in bed. And I'm also a mother and showing the whole person. And I'm expecting all my readers to be a whole person.
Yeah. And I guess it's really refreshing for your audience to have someone who meets them at eye level. Because I think a lot of people's experience with fashion is that it's not usually like that at all. It's often aspirational to the point of being fanciful.
Yeah.
So growing up, did you have any role models that you could identify with or helped encourage you to express yourself authentically?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I really looked up to Liam Gallagher. But it's true. I remember I got hooked on Oasis on their second album because I'm obviously a bit younger. So I think I was 12 when their second album came out. And that was when I saw him for the first time. I'm like, oh my God, what energy. He is so cool. He doesn't care about anyone. No, he doesn't care what anyone thinks of him. But it's about believing in yourself. I'm like, that guy believes in himself. I want to be like that. I want to be in a position where I creatively don't make any compromises. And I really wanted to be cool as well. I've always wanted to be cool.
The interesting thing about that from my perspective is it shows that you've never limited yourself to seeking inspiration from within the same art form. I presume then that you're constantly keeping an eye on what's happening outside textiles and fashion.
Yeah, of course. Well, I've always, I like fashion. I like clothing. I like clothing so much. I love it. I love all pieces of clothing. I love cheap clothing and old clothing and dirty clothing and all kinds of clothes. Fashion, high fashion, low fashion, whatever. My dad's clothes and my kids' clothes and everything is, it's an expression. But I never really looked up to fashion designers because it's just too close. Like, I look up to them. And I'm a big fan of Demna, of course, and Alexander McQueen and everyone. I love all the geniuses, but I find it more interesting to cross over to other creative media. So I'm very much influenced by music, and I always was, because there's so much energy in music. There's so much personality in musicians. Well, of course, in fashion as well, but they're selling something else. And there's also more freedom in being a musician than there are in being a fashion designer.
So are there any aspects of fashion that you don't like? Are there things that annoy you about it?
Yeah, most things about fashion annoy me. Well, I don't like the whole, the whole industry, basically, it sucks, I think. People are not nice to each other, and we make shit that pollutes the climate, and the whole buying to wear to look cool is, well, but I really like the expression part of it. So I guess I'm a very conflicted person because I'm in an industry that is basically the worst industry ever. It's an evil industry. And for me, it's, I was very depressed about studying fashion and textile, because how am I ever going to do anything that's going to not be horrible to the planet? And so for me in the beginning, it was about creating with the stuff I already had. I had basically always done it, which I realized later on that, you know, I'd saved all my cutoffs of all this stuff and then tied them together since I was completely young, because I didn't have any money to buy yarn. Yarn is very expensive. And then it sort of became this thing for me that, why not use everything? Let's cut the t-shirts, or let's also the old duvet covers and everything, and then the yarn things. And then I thought, wow, it really looks good. It looks better than when I buy new stuff.
That to me has been really interesting, because you seem to have led this movement of riling up against perfection. As you mentioned, more out of necessity. I note that when you were studying, you used a lot of the offcuts because it was either buy more yarn or buy beer.
Yeah.
A woman's got to make decisions.
Yeah.
So I'm interested in your journey of accepting not being perfect. You've mentioned in the past that when you moved to Copenhagen, you were suffering from an eating disorder.
Yeah.
Looking back on that now, what influence do you think that's had on the way that you see yourself today and how you express yourself through your art?
As you said, I had struggled with an eating disorder actually since I was 15 years old. I was bulimic and anorexic. And then I moved to Copenhagen, and because we didn't have Instagram and we didn't have Facebook, and actually we didn't have any smartphones either. So my mom and my stepdad, they couldn't see me. So I stopped eating the day I came to Copenhagen, which is, it's a bigger story for today, I think, why, but it had a lot to do with control and also, I think, low self-esteem and these big dreams that I thought was never going to happen. So I wasn't sick. I call it sick. That's my words. I wasn't sick that long. Actually, only just around a year. Well, I'd been struggling with it since I was 15, but I was really, really thin and for only a year, around a year. And I started in this rehabilitation program with 7 other girls. And I spent 5 months in that, just taking a break from everything else. And I was supposed to be there, I think, 6 or 7 months, but then I stopped because it was too much and it was a lot. And I felt like I was going in the right direction and I had gained the proper amount of weight. And then I realized afterwards that all the energy that I had put into denying myself food and not eating was some sort of constant energy. I'm like, if I can do that, I can do fucking anything. Because if I can deny myself the only thing my body really wants to function, I must have this enormous amount of strength and energy. And then I thought, okay, I'm unstoppable. If I can torture myself so much and deprive myself of what I really need, I can do anything. So then I was like, I'll use this energy or strength that I'd used for the negative, for the positive. And then I applied for design school, and I want to say the rest is history. A lot happened in between, but it was like someone lit a match under me, and then I just ran like hell in the right direction.
Yeah. That's such a beautiful way of reframing something that was so traumatic for you.
Yeah. And then because you asked about the whole perfection thing, I realized afterwards that I had strived within my eating disorder to be thin and Copenhagen-ish. I wanted to be like a Copenhagener. Oh, I don't know what that is. Fashionable and perfect. And then I'm like, I don't know anyone that are perfect. And the people that I know that are the most perfect people are the most boring people. I don't want to do that. I wanted the freedom to be myself. And then realizing that all the most interesting people I had ever met was the non-perfect ones. Perfection is so boring.
But I'm curious about your thoughts on where we are today, because let's just limit it to Denmark or even to Copenhagen. I mean, do we have a perfection obsession as a society?
I think so. It's become better. I think maybe 5 years ago it was a lot worse. I think now people want to engage with real people, either being online or where you buy the products or which movies you watch or art or whatever. You want to engage with real people. Everything is so polished. And now we have the whole AI creating like perfect images or perfect texts, and you can get everything perfect. And it's,
It's boring for you.
Yeah, really. It's really boring. You know what? I came here meeting you. And then because, you know, I sit a lot in my work, so I try to walk, and I realized because I have 2 small kids and I had a really busy morning, I had forgotten to put on deodorant this morning. And then I felt really embarrassed coming up to you. So I went straight to Kvickly and then I bought a deodorant, and then I went into this passage. Then I was like putting on deodorant, and then someone came by and I was like, sorry, I forgot. And then they laughed at me. And then we had a moment. 2 people meeting, having a moment because someone laughed at me because I put on deodorant and I forgot. That was an interaction with another person that I didn't know.
And it doesn't fit into a pretty box.
It really doesn't.
Yeah. So how would you then, and you probably hate this as a designer and a creative, but how would you then articulate your style?
Oh, yeah, that question I really hate. No, it's good because, they try to teach us at design school how to communicate our vision and our work, and we really don't want to communicate it because we want our work to speak for itself. But
isn't it true that your teacher at university said that it was 10% effort, 20% insight, and 70% communication?
Yeah. Yeah.
So I've been sent from your university to test you, Lagerbagger.
To see if I really am. But the thing is that I was never the star student. Oh, I wasn't the most talented one at school. But I think I was one of the most annoying ones. Like, I'm sorry, I'm going to do it again, because I was pounding on the doors and I was calling people. And I was, look at my work, look at my work. So I can't describe the style of my designs, but I can describe the style of my... what word am I looking for? You know,
your personality.
Yeah, because that's what brought me here to where I am today. Also sitting with you is because I'm not going to take no for an answer. And I'm always going to keep pushing the boundaries for what craft can do. And then I'm going to show it to everyone and talk to everyone about it. The first interview I ever gave was when I was in my second year at design school. And my friend was in media school. And she had an assignment to do a 5-minute video of someone who did something with their hands. And she ended up doing a 3-hour interview with me because I couldn't shut up. And then she had to edit it down to 5 minutes. You know, that says a lot about me when it comes to my work and craft. So I am maybe 90% communication and then 5% talent and 5% insight.
But what interests me particularly about you is that you strike me as someone who's incredibly impatient and constantly looking at the next thing.
I am so impatient.
But you're knitting.
Yeah.
You're taking months at a time to craft a single garment.
But if you think about it and look at my creations, something new happens all the time. It's a new bead, it's a new color, because I can't even do 2 centimeters of the same color because I get bored. I am so impatient. It's really true. And I'm so impatient that it borders on being rude. Like my family won't, like if we're in an airport, they walk 5 meters behind me because they're embarrassed to walk with me because I'm so impatient. Oh, yeah.
So for someone as impatient as yourself, can you just take me into your mindset when you're working? Because when you're knitting for hours on end, where is your mind at? Is it a meditative state? Are you constantly thinking about next steps? Are you reflecting on life's big questions? Are you watching brain dead television? Are you listening to Oasis? What's happening?
All of those, actually. But, you know, there are several phases. So the first phase is the experimental creative phase where I have this very loose idea. Maybe it's the glimpse of an image of a feeling or a sense I want to create. And then I start creating. And in that part of the whole process, I don't listen to anything. I don't watch anything. I only think about the next step and hitting the right path. Or like, you want to go on that street that just takes you all the way around. It was a weird analogy, but you know.
Oh, I get it.
Yeah. And then when you hit the street or you hit the path, then I can listen to something for maybe, let's say, 2 kilometers. And then I walk the 2 kilometers. And then I have to decide whether I'm going left or right or straight. And then maybe there's 2 kilometers of the road where I'm constantly thinking about what happens next. And then maybe there's 10 kilometers where I can watch Real Housewives. And then I'm back. So I'm constantly revisiting the creative process. So it's like 2 kilometers of crisis and I don't know, we're GPSing and what way are we going? And then the GPS fucks up and then, okay, oh, all right, now we're onto the Autobahn and now we can, there's a Raststätte, okay, we can go and have a Currywurst and I can see this and then I'm back and then the GPS fucked up again. You know, that's what it's like.
And how often are you completely surprised by the destination when you arrive?
Every time. And that's because I keep the process open. I have tried to create something that I made. I made a drawing and then I'm like, this is what I want to do. But it never turns out well. And most of the time, I don't even finish because I find it so boring that I'm already closing the process before I even start doing it. And also because I am so impatient and because my craft is such a slow one. It's not like if you're a chef, you can make something in a day. So I have to keep the process open. Otherwise, I'll never finish because it will be so boring because it's several weeks or months, right?
Yeah. Well, you started by talking about the thrill that you get from others remixing your patterns. It's essentially like you're remixing your own work on a regular basis.
Yeah. So I always only make one. I never make the same thing twice because it's boring. I moved on. Which is, I'm really struggling with it because my new book is coming out this week. And now this whole sales thing, like I want people to buy the book. So I have to keep the book alive by making the stuff from the book. But the problem is I already made it. So I don't want to do it anymore.
You've moved on.
I have really moved on. And now I'm like, Saturday, I bought a hole punch and it's lying on my table. And then I bought some old leather pieces in a charity shop and I'm not allowed to open it. But I really want to because I want to do something else now.
Yeah. The mantra for the new book is knit it out.
Yeah.
What does that mean?
Knit it out was a sentence that got stuck in my head while working on the new book. The new book is like a coming of age knitting book, also a knitting biography about my relationship to my biological father who died 5 years ago. And we had a really difficult relationship our entire life. So I wanted to tell that story in the broader sense of how craft can really help you heal mentally and how it helped me throughout all the problems with him. So knit it out was like, knit your feelings out or your grief or your anger or your sadness or your joy. Because I looked at my knitting throughout those years with him and I could see the different phases of my mental state in my knitting.
Wow.
Yeah. But really not wow, actually, because it's like, of course. But you know, wow, but yeah, of course. You know, people have regarded art being that for years. And then they are like surprised that, of course, it's the same way with craft. It's nothing different.
Mm. Your father lived in Greenland for quite a long time. Yeah. I know you had a tumultuous relationship with him. Were you able to reconcile by the end?
No. Oh. No, sorry. We had we hadn't seen each other for 3 years when he called and told me he was sick and he was going to die. And then we had 3 months together. But he was angry and he was going to die. So, well, of course, he was in another state. So we never really managed to find each other. But I was there for him till the end.
Today, as we sit here, do you know in yourself that he loved you?
Yeah, I always knew that. I always knew that he loved me. But it wasn't really so much the question of whether he loved me or not. It was maybe the question of him accepting me and also being, I want to say the bigger person, but the older person, like being a parent. He wasn't the perfect parent. And I took a lot of responsibility for our relationship from a very early age. And I needed to, I guess, work through that. And this book helped me do that. So I just as much made the book for myself than for other people.
Are there any images of him in the book?
Yeah. Yeah, I decided if I'm going to do this book, I'm not going to hold anything back. Either you go all the way or don't do it. And I guess that's very much how I work all the time. Let's go all the way or I don't want to. Let's not then.
So do you feel with this book and the catharsis that came from writing it that you now have a true sense of closure?
No. Like losing a parent and regretting a whole life's relationship with that parent will never leave you. But it helped me, like, I had put everything in a box because he died the same year that I became a mother for the first time. So everything happened. It was life and death. And then suddenly my knitting career took off. And, you know, I'd never really sat down and opened that box of sadness and sorrow and regret. And so I had to open the box. And I feel like now I've sorted the stuff in the box. I'm not afraid to open the box and then put the lid on, but I was really afraid to open the box before I wrote this book. But, you know, I'll always regret what happened. But now I'm like, I'm not angry or saddened to regret it.
Yeah. Are you the kind of person that likes to talk it out with people, these kind of feelings? Or
no.
Are you someone who... No.
No, okay. I only talk to people in podcasts. I don't talk to people in real life. You're laughing, but it's actually quite true. I don't really like to have these long, deep conversations, but I think it's because I'm impatient.
Mm.
I think maybe I could do it if I was knitting, but, you know, I don't know what to do with my hands. Maybe you've noticed that I do like all stuff with my hands the whole time I'm sitting here talking to you. I'm more about telling the stories through my knitting needles. I think, you know, my friend, I don't want to sound, I don't know if this makes me sound bad. My friend, she made this celebratory post about me yesterday because I walked her fashion show last week. And then she said that I always make her make her points in less than 30 seconds. If she can't get a point across to me in 30 seconds, I'm like, I'm out. Which sounds bad now I'm saying it, but you know, it's, she likes it. She's a designer too.
She gets it.
Yeah, she gets it.
So we talked about maybe the negative, but what's the best compliment a friend could give Lerke Bagger?
Well, she, can I read what she, is it weird? Because she is in English. I really want, because I felt like she really described me. It's really, I was so moved that I actually cried a little bit. Lerke, you give me no more than 30 seconds to make a point. You tell me to get started when I get stuck in my mind. You don't like long hugs, and you wrinkle your nose when people say scat. That's like babe or love. You are unfiltered. You are so real in anything you do or say that you break down any barrier. Mask off instantly. No one can resist. You are a crafting queen, an artist. You have style more than most fashionistas. You might love Liam, but you just walked that show better than any of your fellow rock stars could have ever done. You advised me to keep my work close to myself, and you inspired me to dare to bring more of myself. I'm just like, I'm so moved. It's...
Those are beautiful words.
Really, right? But it's like, I really, I am... These words, I think, are the best words ever. You are unfiltered. You are so real in anything you do or say that you break down any barrier. Mask off instantly, no one can resist. That's like the most beautiful words ever, right?
Mm. But that rings so true with just my initial impression of you as well, that you feel so comfortable in your own skin. And I think that makes others feel the same way.
Well, you know what? I really don't feel that comfortable. I just feel comfortable also being uncomfortable. Do you know what I mean? I don't ever want to feel smooth sailing. Like life is like, I'm doing like the straight line now in the air. But if there's no highs and lows, what's the point? You can't feel the highs if you don't feel the lows. Last week, I was really, because my book is coming out on Friday, and it's a really personal book. Like, it's a really personal book, and I might have regretted a teeny weeny spot. Like, now it's really hitting me that a lot of people are going to read my story. And then last week, I was actually, I had a really bad week. I was so insecure, and I was so raw, and also, I had to say my stomach was just acting out and my skin was breaking out. And then I wrote about it on Instagram, having talks and discussions and small messages from people that feel the same way and that are either the same place or just over that, or people just wanting to let me know that they're there, which is like, you should always be vulnerable. There's so much strength in vulnerability. In real life and in design.
And it's just so great to hear that you can use your community on Instagram for that. And it always feels with your account that there's no agenda behind it more than just to make connections.
There really is no agenda. There's really no agenda. You know, of course, I want to show like cool knits, but it's mostly about reaching out because I felt so alone for so many years doing the craft. And then Instagram came along and then we connected. Me and all the American and Australian and Swedish and also people from Jutland, and we connected and we could just find each other and crawl out from the rocks that we came from and just shine in the sun.
Hmm. We talk about confidence and self-confidence. When Miley Cyrus's team reach out and want to acquire a couple of your pieces, many would just bow to the altar of celebrity and hand over the goods, but you did something else.
Yeah, I... You know, after the immediate high and like, whoa, had like, I realized that I think they have a certain way of writing. So it really felt like they wanted it for free. But I think most celebrities get stuff for free. That's how it works. But I didn't have any money. And the pieces that she wanted was some of the most amazing and also work heavy and material heavy pieces that I had. So I was like, I'm so honored. I spent like a whole day figuring out what to write in an email, a whole day. And then I wrote back something like, I'm so honored. And then the prices of the jumpers, because I couldn't give them for free. I also didn't want to by principle. I get why like Balenciaga or everyone else could give stuff for free, but I was only myself. And then she bought them. And she had like this, I don't know, celebrity FedEx. This guy came and he like wrapped the stuff, and it's like a whole different experience when you're sending packages.
Are you saying celebrities have their own special FedEx?
They do. I'm telling you, they do. They have like gold account or something. It was a completely different experience. I've never experienced anything like it.
So that then leads to the question, has it been hard for you to know your worth from day one, or have you just stuck to your guns? Because I know that that's something that a lot of artists grapple with early on, is exposure versus opportunity.
Absolutely. It's hard and it's still hard. But I stuck to my guns from the very beginning. And actually what I'm doing now is that I don't sell my stuff because people won't pay what it's worth. So I'd rather not sell. So I'm collecting now for, this is going to sound pompous or something, but I feel like some museum should make like a textile whatever with me or all other textile artists. So I'm like collecting everything now because, you know, you can't make a living doing hand knit.
Mm.
It's just impossible. I want to see that person who makes a living selling hand-knitted jumpers they make themselves that are not made in India. It can't be done. People won't pay, even though it's really amazingly knitted jumpers like the beaded ones, they won't pay the same amount for a knitted jumper that they will for a piece of art they can hang on the wall.
Yeah, because I could imagine if you were to quantify it, we're talking well in excess of 10,000 euros, given the time and the materials.
Also, you know, I'm not really interested in production. But, you know, like I said earlier, I can only do one. So I have to change. And then people don't want to buy the next one you make, which is slightly different. They want to buy the one they've seen, which is understandable if they're going to pay a lot of money. But I'm like, oh, but I thought about widening the sleeves a bit and then maybe doing in a different... No, we want that one. I can only do one.
So that leads me to the question, you're at the intersection of fashion, art, and craft.
Yeah.
Have you ever felt that that's an awkward position to be in because you then don't belong to a particular tribe or specific peer group?
Actually, the quite opposite. I feel free. I feel like I'm the one that has, I have it good. I wouldn't want to be boxed in with fashion. I don't want to be boxed in with the craft. I don't want to be boxed in as a hand knit designer. I want to do everything and I want to be able to do everything. I don't ever want to be boxed in or labeled. And I think that's also why I am at this intersection, is because I refuse to be labeled. So whenever I felt like someone had like pushed me in that direction, so now I've done this for a while, then I thought, okay, I might as well, I have to go in the other direction because I don't want to be labeled fashion or hand knit. And I don't want to be an artist either. No. So that's also the strength of me, I think. People always never know what to expect, and they like it.
Just as we draw to a close, Lager, you recently embarked on a journey along with Christina Feldhaus, the Danish lifestyle journalist, to create a television series whereby you explored how other cultures traditionally approach knitting. So the two of you traveled to Norway, Greenland, Iceland and the Faroe Islands.
Yeah.
I'm just curious, for someone as knowledgeable about the craft as yourself, what were you most surprised to learn from that experience in terms of how other cultures approach knitting?
Well, that's a good question. You know, I wasn't really surprised though. I knew that in the Faroe Islands and in Iceland as well, and Norway, of course, they had this almost religious relationship with wool that we don't have here in Denmark. We have some sheep in Fyn, which is part of Denmark, and we talk about the sheep, but in Iceland and in the Faroe Islands and in Norway, sheep is like, it's sheep. And wool is not just wool, it's wool. And, you know, I have, because I like to use everything, and also I don't want to be labeled or boxed, as we talked about. So no one is going to tell me that I can only use real wool. Because if I'm told that I was going to use real wool, I'm going to do something else. Nobody tell me what to do. But if I was going to mention one thing that I was surprised about, it was not surprised, but it was like really left an impression with me, is this fundamental relationship with knitting. here in Denmark, we don't have the same relationship with knitting as a historical thing or a traditional thing. Of course, we've done it always, but in Iceland and in the Faroe Islands and in Norway and in Greenland, it was done out of necessity and sometimes saving lives. And knitting and the wool and the sheep and the whole craft thing, it's so much more rooted in their cultural history.
Yeah.
So that left a really big impression. You know, we almost, me and Christina almost died on a mountain in the Faroe Islands because we were out gathering the sheep to go in the fold, which is, it looks easy, it's not.
I saw it. It was extremely steep.
And then we had all these like Faroese sheep professionals. I don't want to sound like, I don't know, I don't remember. A sheep.
Yeah, sheep herders.
Yeah. That's what I was going for, not the sheep professionals. Because apparently some of the sheep, okay, we're losing them because they were going in, I don't know which direction. And then they just ran, like 20 men. They ran after the sheep. And then me and Christina were like alone on a mountain. And we just, okay, let's go that way. Which led us to like a side of the mountain that was so steep that we actually couldn't go either back or forth. So we had to be picked up by some of the production team and also the sheep herders and crawl through like a small stream. And there was 50 meters down and there was a concrete motorway. And I cried and Christina wanted to have a cigarette, but her ass was on her back. So she was afraid if she moved her ass, she was going to fall and die. So she couldn't have her last cigarette. And we almost died on the mountain. And I was like, I'm never doing this again. And then we lived and then we went on a mountain next week in Iceland.
And it all made for great television.
No one filmed it.
I saw the sheep run amok.
Yeah, because the camera crew, they were following the sheep. So no one filmed our near-death experience where we actually thought we were going to die.
Well, I'm glad you didn't. As a final question, you seem to constantly have your antenna up for potential collaborations. And you've talked about not taking rejection personally.
Yeah.
Can you speak a little bit to your experience with approaching people as an artist and how that has changed or remained the same over time?
It's remained the same over time. Even though in your introduction, you said sought after knitwear designer, I'm still not sought after all the time. Like some people are. So I really like collaborations because they tend to get me out of my comfort zone because you have to relate to something else which is outside of you, which also makes you think in a different way and then also change your way of working so you make something new. So I really like collaborations. And sometimes I see something, I think, okay, that's cool. I want to do a collaboration with them. And then I write them an email and then they say no. Or sometimes they don't even answer, actually. I think 2 weeks ago, I wrote an email to someone I wanted to do a collaboration with. They haven't answered me. Don't think I ever will. And I've done so many fun collaborations and had so many good experiences from approaching people that it's like, who cares if someone won't reply to me or they don't want to work with me? Usually, if you get a no, they're polite enough to say, sorry, it's a bad time, or we've got our plate full. They're not going to write, your work sucks. We don't ever want to work with you. So believe in the best. And then, you know, I believe in my work. So if people say no to me, it's not necessarily because I'm a bad designer or a bad person or, you know, whatever. It could just be like timing or maybe they don't like my stuff. Who cares? I don't like everything.
How far could this collaborative spirit and willingness to step out of your own comfort zone take you? Could you just tease or hint at something as to how wild it could get?
I feel like I should do like a collaboration with NASA, doing knitting in space or like whatever. You know, it could do like big, who knows? If I find it interesting, I'm going to go for it. Was that a good answer?
Knitting in space is a bloody good answer.
I think so.
We will watch with great interest.
I think I should go in space and then I should do like...
Yeah. It can't be someone else.
No, it has to be me.
Yeah. Laga, it's been an absolute pleasure talking to you, and I just want to thank you for taking the time to share your story so openly with us today.
It's been wonderful. I feel like I have to put on deodorant again because I've been moving so much around with my hands and I'm all red in my face. It's been a real pleasure. Thank you.
Nordic Portraits is a series by me,
Ben Catford. The music was composed by Nina Liu and the visual identity by Copenhagen-based studio Frame. To learn more about today's guest and all the others from this season, visit nordicportraits.net. You can also follow us on Instagram and remember to rate and subscribe on iTunes so we can get the word out. Thanks for listening.